There is no health without mental health. Hi, welcome to Beyond Meds. I am your host, Professor Christopher Paul Sabo. I'm a psychiatrist, and this podcast series features psychiatrists in conversation with myself, discussing mental health issues, issues that affect our society on a daily basis. Emotional issues can affect you or someone in your life at some point, and the intention of this podcast series is to give you a better understanding of psychiatry. Beyond Madness is proudly brought to you by Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave. On today's podcast, I have the pleasure of interviewing a respected and well-known psychiatrist, Dr. Sean Bowman, to discuss his new book, Madness, Stories of Uncertainty and Hope, which chronicles patient histories that go beyond conventional portrayals of mental illness. Ankie Kroch, no less, a leading South African literary figure, has said, "This book has irrevocably changed my understanding of madness." High praise, indeed. Certainly, I've read the book and found the content accessible, informative, and importantly, a sensitive account of madness, and covering a wide range of topical issues within the discipline of psychiatry. And I need to mention, I found the prologue very evocative, from the title, "The Hospital on the Other Side of the River," to the content, which for me had shades of J.M. Coetzee's Waiting for the Barbarians and Life and Times of Michael Kay. Sean, with that lengthy introduction, welcome. It's lovely to have you join me in conversation on the podcast. And let me leap in with a big question. What does madness mean to you, and why the choice of the word madness for the book title?
Chris, thank you for inviting me. I'm very aware that it's provocative and possibly problematic, but I do using the word madness very, very sort of deliberately.
Yes.
Because the book is really to try and take the subject beyond or outside the strictly medical domain, because that's the language we use in the street, and that's in a way part of the problem. But the large part of the book is really a deep concern about the way we use the term madness, the way we think about madness, and the consequence of this in terms of exclusion and stigma. So I wanted to deal with the issue head on, I suppose, by using this term madness and trying to understand the different ways in which to see the different meanings that are attached to the word madness. And often the dismissive or derogatory meaning. Mm. So it really, this is rather possibly ambitiously trying to change the way we think about madness.
I must say, I like that, because in a sense, we're tackling something head on. We're touching on a sensitive word, which actually leads us into a very sensitive area and a very sensitive topic. And I think that so much of today's conversation eventually leads to self-censorship, where we cannot use certain words, we cannot say certain things.
Yeah.
And if we don't call something by its name or use a word that could be used as a descriptor in a potentially derogatory way and start to open a conversation about the meaning of that word and how we might think about it differently, then I think we're non-starters. I don't know how you'd respond to that.
I absolutely agree. And I do think we need to be completely open and frank about the term in order to diminish its adverse uses and the damaging effect this has. But you know, we can't avoid, because that's the language we use. Madness.
Yes.
We don't talk about schizophrenia spectrum disorders or even psychotic disorders or severe mental illness. That's not how people think about it. And
yes.
not the words that they use. So, I don't think there's an easy answer to this, because I'm really concerned about the hurt that the use of this term might give. But I'm really, just as you've said, the idea in a sense is to really just start a conversation, to have an open, honest debate about it.
And what
because
I like,
it does affect us, as you said in your, sorry, I'm interrupting, Chris, but as you said in your introduction, this is something that affects us all.
Yes. And what I wanted to say was, I think it's very brave, and I think it's very important, because at the end of the day, one is maybe throwing down a marker and saying, you know what, it's time we started looking at things as they are. And I think what you're saying is so important, where you're saying, but you know, this word is commonly used. This is in common parlance, and it's got a certain meaning. And unless we as psychiatrists are prepared not to shy away from it, because you know we don't want to go there, we actually do go there, and we say, okay, what does this term actually mean?
Sure.
And we kind of, I don't say appropriate it or take ownership of it, but we are not fearful of actually engaging with it, because there's almost a sense that, wow, you're a psychiatrist, but you're using the word madness, even for the title of this podcast, Beyond Madness. And I'm saying, no, no.
We have to go beyond.
I want to take you behind the scenes. I want people to understand that psychiatry is a thinking discipline with multiple issues that affect not just psychiatry, but society in general. So like I say, I think it's a great title. And I really, as I said, commend you for having the boldness to say, you know what, I'm stepping up. This has got to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And so it brings me to my next question. Why did you write the book?
Well, it follows on very much from what we've been discussing, Christopher, is that there's a very real concern that, for me, I believe that our misunderstanding of madness, and to use another more careful terminology, severe mental illness, our misunderstanding, the misapprehension of these very often incredibly complex and sad conditions leads to enormous suffering, both on the part of our patients and their families, these misunderstandings. So really the next, in a way, part of the book has been started in a sense with some anger about our careless ways of conceptualizing madness. And the next question, I suppose, was, you know, why is this so? What maintains these misapprehensions,
yes,
or these almost willful misunderstandings of these extraordinary conditions? And so that's where it all began. And then I thought, well, if they could just sort of complaining, you know, that people just don't understand, well, then Gretchen, and certainly with my clinical experience in the public health sector, and particularly in the field of psychotic disorder, well, can't I at least try and, certainly from a sort of very personal viewpoint, try and articulate in a sort of authentic and hopefully respectful way my understanding about mental illness? And
I was going to say it's quite interesting. I think you used the word magnificent. Did you use the word magnificent?
Well, I have on
these disorders?
Yes.
Because I think that in a sense you're showing a very deep respect for what a patient experiences when their world becomes somewhat different to how we might understand the world to be. And I often think to myself, if one has ever been psychotic, i.e. out of touch with reality, how do you ever know what reality is? Have you ever kind of thought about that? Because it kind of struck me. I thought, well, if that wasn't real, what is real?
Next step, I suppose, Christopher, was that I think if we do consider the phenomena of madness, then we need to consider some of the issues that this phenomena raises, and I think that has to do with consciousness, with notions of the self, with notions of free will, of notions of what constitutes an external reality. And I think that's why this and you and I have been deeply fascinated by this field, because I think it does raise a whole host of intriguing philosophical issues.
And I think what is quite incredible is the power of medication on the one hand to actually not necessarily cure, but in most instances provide some kind of alleviation and some kind of reversal of this loss of sense of reality where one is experiencing the world in such a profoundly disturbed way. It's actually almost miraculous in a way. It's one of the real powers of psychiatry, which I don't know is fully appreciated or understood.
And I didn't think so. And I that's another, it's one thing talking about madness, but I think I also wanted to talk about what psychiatry does and what it can do, and certainly with regard to schizophrenia and schizophrenia spectrum disorders, how I think I do somewhere in the book say that I could, the whole unit would, the whole service would have shut down within 3 or 4 weeks if I didn't have access to these very effective medications.
Yes, and I think that is very, very important, Sean. I mean, you know, I'm not even sure that we as psychiatrists necessarily always take that step back and say, wow, what are we doing here with a pill?
Yes.
You know, how is this working?
Sure.
And look at the profound change that you see in patients who were floridly psychotic and completely out of touch and a risk to themselves, to others. They settle, they get perspective, and suddenly they're back in touch. I mean, isn't it amazing?
It is. And I think sometimes it really is possibly one of the most exciting things I've encountered in medicine, watching somebody emerge from a psychosis. But I think what I did want to emphasize also is that I think we need to be clear about the focus of attention. I think
yes,
you use the word reality in the argument about reality. I think quite understandably in the depth of a psychosis, somebody says, why are you taking this reality away from me? This is my reality. To try and eliminate my reality. And so the argument then would be that this, what you're describing to me, surely is something incredibly distressing and frightening. And can't we just shift the attention in a way to that? That I'm not here to alter your reality because it's personal to you and intense and meaningful, but I'm here to try and help you by diminishing the distress associated with what you're going through.
You know, it's quite interesting because as you're talking, I'm thinking, do you think patients ever miss that?
I do think so, absolutely. I think so, but I think that's what something we can neglect in our practice, Christopher, is that we, and I know this is a little bit controversial, I'm hesitant about this, but these experiences are meaningful to our patients very often. And what are we doing when we're taking away that meaning?
Yes, and I think I'd like you to, if you can, just kind of elaborate on that, because you see, there's an assumption or a presumption, we must always do good, do no harm, we step in, we experience their behavior, their thought processes as clearly deleterious to themselves, having negative consequences, and so therefore we must do something. Yeah. And now we kind of say, well, can we look at it from the other perspective to say, to what extent is that reality comfortable for them? And I mean, I know it would not necessarily be a popular point of view, but I think it's worth exploring.
It's something we have to consider romantic, but if this person is trying to make, one metaphor is noise, and I think noise is intolerable, and I think I use this metaphor on many occasions.
Yes.
So there's noise, which we can imagine on a kind of neurobiological level. So the patient using cultural idioms, using personal narratives, whatever it might be, tries to make sense of this intolerable phenomenon of noise. And so it's idiosyncratic, it's weird, it's strange, but it's the first tentative steps to try and regain control. That's one way of conceptualizing.
Yes.
And if we can, in a sort of way, say, look, I see what you're trying to do. I'm here to help you. And in a way, hopefully, in a collaborative way, try and help them regain themselves to recover.
And I think that's so critical, this issue of collaboration, which is not just you're ill, here's your treatment, that's what you've got to do. Now you're normal, in inverted commas, you're okay, cheers. Yeah. Off you go and live your life as that new person or that restored person.
Sure. And that was an enormous expense, an intense expense. And how can we just dismiss it? How can we just, as you say, neglect something that is intensely meaningful or profound to our patients? So it means putting it in the right place, I suppose.
Yes. And I think that one of the issues that we often grapple with in psychiatry, specifically in the treatment of psychosis, is compliance. And I suppose a lot of what we're talking about now, or have been talking for the last few minutes, has profound implications for the inclination of the patient to continue this medication.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's why it's so important, I think, in this collaborative sense to contextualize what we're doing, because otherwise they're saying, all you're doing is suppressing symptoms, doctor. Well, that's all you're doing, and it's banal.
Do you think, and of course I can't expect you to know, and I'm not sure if I know myself, do you think that psychiatrists spend enough time engaging with patients who are recovered, and I'm putting that in inverted commas, who have recovered a semblance of normality, to really explore the comparison between what they were experiencing and what they are now experiencing as a consequence of an intervention?
I think that's absolutely right, Christopher. I think it, it, it's enormously important that I think I used the word just a little while ago about contextualizing it. I think that's critically important to enable somebody to sustain their recovery. What does that all mean? And why am I taking this medication? It's just so surely easy and understandable that someone's going to that there's the treatment because it doesn't mean it's not been given any meaning. It's not been contextualized in what the function of what we're trying to do is. And I think we've got to be clear in our own minds about it. And I think we need to explain that very carefully to our patients. And that's why I think forming relationships and trusting relationships and continuity of care are so important, and how difficult that is, of course, in the public sector.
Do you think that what we're speaking about now is necessarily adequately taught to our specialists in training and is something which is commonly understood as an important component of delivering care?
There's a straightforward answer. I think the answer is no, it's not. But I recognize this is a fairly personal sort of way of making sense of it. So I accept that. But I also think we're all familiar with the phenomenon of people getting disenchanted and cynical. We're surrounded by our colleagues who think, what the hell are we doing? I think if we reimagine what we're doing as something really quite profound and meaningful to ourselves, also in trying to understand what people are going through, the extraordinary expenses. I use this word with great hesitation, but we retrieve a sense of wonder in these different worlds and finding ways of making sense of these expenses. I think we can make our work so much more richer and hopefully gratifying. And I think more effective.
I think you are right, but this requires almost like an immersive experience where you kind of immerse yourself in this strange world that you can't necessarily relate to as the treating psychiatrist in order to get an understanding of, okay, what is it that my patient has been through? Where am I taking them to? And how do you build a bridge to make that transition from psychosis to no psychosis? And so for me, it's about time. And I think that coming from a public sector, even a private sector setting, do we spend the time? Do we have the time? And might we get better results with a greater understanding of the need for this kind of experience? I don't know how you...
Absolutely. No, I entirely agree. It's not do we have the luxury of the time. It's intrinsic to the work that we do is that we spend time. So we're respecting our patients to grant them the space in which they can articulate what they're going through. It's necessary. It's not a luxury. It's intrinsic to the work we do.
And so I think that is very important, Sean. It's actually not a luxury. But unfortunately, time has become a luxury based on pressures in the service and the need to process patients. And in a way, it concerns me that we are missing, and you use the words richness. And I'm not just thinking about the richness of our experience as clinicians, but the richness of pathology that our patients have that we need to engage with.
Yeah, and paying attention to that and there's, in a way, the shared drama of it and the extraordinary aspects of it that sustained me for, 30 years in acute service at Falkenberg Hospital, because I just was found myself deeply, deeply moved and fascinated by these stories.
Well, I think the stories are fascinating, and one has to be careful that one is not some kind of voyeur looking at a fascinating story, because what you're dealing with is not a movie, it's a real life. And this person is now experiencing the world in a way which is completely outside of your experience as a clinician, hopefully. And, you know, so this is not just, wow, this is an interesting patient. I think, I mean, my initial journey into psychiatry was more along those lines, like, wow, this is really interesting. This is fascinating. And it took me a long time. And I don't know that anybody ever really taught me what we're speaking about, except my initial, I must say, one of my early experiences dealt with sitting behind a psychiatrist who was interviewing a patient, and the patient was talking about auditory hallucinations, so hearing voices of people that don't exist, and what they were saying to her and how they distressed her, and I burst out laughing. I burst out laughing. Yeah. And the patient pointed a finger at me and said in Afrikaans, "Jy kan lach, you can laugh." And I felt kind of, sort of, I was like, okay, but isn't this amusing? Right. I hadn't understood the distress. And the psychiatrist, I'll never forget, turned around to me and he said, "You've learned a first lesson." He said, "You can always laugh with a patient, never at a patient."
Great. And, fantastic.
And I was a fourth year medical student, and I kind of walked out of there, and it's never left me. And I think so, it was a very good schooling of trying to get into the experience of the patient in terms of what they describe.
Christopher, I think that's critically important in terms of our forming a trusting relationship. And I think that we cannot intervene helpfully and if we do not acknowledge what our patients are going through. I think if I think of some of the difficulties that I've had and the anger of the patients and the anger of the patients with their own families and with the community is because it's real for them, and we have to understand that it's real for them and acknowledge that reality. If we didn't have that sort of foundation, I think what the next steps are doomed to fail.
Well, you see, what concerns me, I think, is that because for us, as those who are not part of that psychotic process or that psychotic world, you're almost looking at it and saying, oh, come on, really?
Yeah.
And I think one has to be careful that one doesn't come across as dismissive, because I think in a sense that's what you're speaking about. It's like, no, you're not respecting that I actually experience this as very real.
And I think that's critical.
Even though
I
think it's very important. So I wanted to just touch on the subtitle of your book, Stories of Uncertainty and Hope. And so I was kind of looking at that and saying, okay, before I attribute any meaning to it, I wanted to understand what your intention and what your meaning was of the subtitle. So it's Madness, Stories of Uncertainty and Hope, and I want to focus on stories of uncertainty and hope. What do you mean by that?
I think both terms, both concepts to me are absolutely critically important. I think one of the difficulties of psychiatry, both for psychiatrists and the public perception of psychiatry, is that it's such an uncertain discipline that we don't, and I suppose following from that, we don't know what to do. And I think it's again, this I suppose is provocative, but it's important in a way to embrace uncertainty, that the false certainties are not helpful at all. And it links back a little bit to what we were saying earlier, that it's sort of inappropriate for closure to say, oh, I know what's going on. You've just got a sort of excessive dopamine transmission, and I'm going to give you this pill, and it's all going to go away. And that just doesn't make sense to me at all. So
exactly.
Uncertainty is is intrinsic, I think, to science. That what propels us to try and understand is acknowledging that uncertainty.
And so these are not mutually exclusive words or concepts. One can have hope in spite of uncertainty. That's what I'm sensing. So I'll let you take it.
With the uncertainty, I mean, following on from what you've just said, really, it creates spaces, and again, this really arises so much out of my clinical experience and my encounters with patients, and importantly, the families. That it's not just encouragement; it's instilling hope. And I think it's something we neglect. And I think because it's not scientific or doesn't have the status of a scientific concept or something that we can measure. But I think it's intrinsic to the work that we do and to the recovery of our patients. And it's being realistic, and again, working with uncertainty, meaning that we don't know what the future holds. I don't know how, to what extent I'm going to be able to help you, but I hope that I will. Especially, I'm so excited for the families to say this is, again, it's one of the perceptions of, I think, say, their mental illness. You've been schizophrenia, particularly, that the situation's hopeless. It's a dreadful, tragic condition, and there's no hope. And it's not true. And I think it's important that we acknowledge that.
I would endorse that, and I would say to you that we need to not fear uncertainty. We need to embrace it, accept that we don't always have all the answers. In fact, mostly we don't have all the answers. Yeah. And that's not a bad thing, because it doesn't mean we can't help you and that there isn't room for improvement. Yeah. And therefore, you know, I mean, when I work with patients, I say, look, let's just move from where we are to the next level. We will create a new foundation of health. And based on that new foundation, let's see if we can move to the next level. Yeah. And so in that,
one step at a
time.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, I know it sounds fairly trite and fairly kind of like self-help psychology kind of approach, but the truth is we have to be pragmatic and we have to be realistic. And I think if we have realistic expectations, then we don't become pessimistic when things don't work out exactly as we want.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And become disheartened and cynical. That's what seems to happen to them.
Precisely. And, and one can easily become disillusioned and then hopeless, in which case, it is hopeless.
And we're not helping.
Exactly. Exactly. So I wanted to ask you, I mean, there are approximately 40 chapters in your book. And so there are many issues that you raise. And you use vignettes, so you use patient histories. And so my question was, did the patients lead you to the issues, or did the issues lead you to the patients?
Patients led me to the issues.
Okay. So I think that...
That's quite straightforward to me. Really, the book arose out of all the issues and the stories that patients were telling me and me.
Yes, and...
You know, I think one of the earlier questions, you said, well, why did you write this book? Another aspect of why I wrote the book is, you know, after all, you always used the word immersion, that I was so immersed in this, that I needed to step back and think, what was that about? What was going on? But and in order to try and make sense of what was going on, to pay careful attention to what my patients had been telling me.
Yes. So I can say to you that as a psychiatrist reading the book, I was able to connect very easily with the issues, because I think you captured so many of the realities of psychiatry. But what I think is very interesting about the book is that you do it in a way which, and I said it right up front, it's very accessible. I like the way in which you've kind of written, and in a very straightforward language, where you take complex issues, actually. And I think, you know, if one has listened to this conversation so far, there is a lot of complexity. I want to ask you a kind of closing question. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the discipline of psychiatry in terms of how you see it evolving?
It's just, I suppose, I'm cautiously optimistic. I know that's not a cop-out. I think psychiatry is an enormously complicated and fascinating and profound branch of medicine. And I think we need to not dismiss either a biomedical model, a reductive biomedical model, or a kind of overly expansive biopsychosocial model, we talked about uncertainty, to be creative in our ways of thinking about how we can help patients. And the very uncertainties are a foundation for being hopeful about the future of psychiatry, because I think it's a fascinating field. But we need to think about it broadly and imaginatively, rather than collapse into familiar, conventional, perhaps rather restrictive models of thinking.
Well, I like that. I think that's a very clear message. Sean, I want to thank you for joining us. Congratulations, and wishing you all the best with your book, Madness, Stories of Uncertainty and Hope, published by Jonathan Ball Publishers, and available, I assume, where good books are sold, and I hope it finds a wide audience. So, Sean, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you, Christopher. Thank you.
Remember, there is no health without mental health. I hope today's podcast has been enlightening. I am Professor Christopher Paul Sabo, and this is Beyond Madness, in proud association with Adcock Ingram OTC, sponsors of Brave.